This recording is produced from Open Reel Tapes, originally recorded for Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus, in 1974. This program forms part of the Langara College Real History Project, which restores and preserves British Columbia's oral history. This project is funded in part by the British Columbia 2000 Millennium Arts and Heritage Fund, in partnership with Vancouver Public Library and Langara College. Copyright for this product is held by Langara College. It may not be reproduced in whole or in part, in any form, without permission from the copyright holder. The title of this recording is Longshoring at Vancouver, BC. The interviewer is Bob Francis. The interviewee is Don Garcia. The audience consists of students at Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus.
Mr. Garcia of the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Workers Union is here to speak to us on Wednesday, October 16th. Mr. Garcia.
Thank you, Mr. Francis. Well, it's, I don't know if it's different. I have a union official here, but I have within my kit there some collective agreements which I've discussed with Mr. Francis, and he thought perhaps they could be distributed. Because contained within that collective agreement, which is really a labor contract, are the conditions under which the men in the port will work. I perhaps should begin by giving you a brief sketch of the way the Canadian area of the Longshoremen's Union works. It's made up of 10 different locals which represent all the major ports on the West Coast. The presidents of all those local unions are together in what's called the Executive Committee, and of this committee, I'm the chairman. I have an elective office which lasts for 2 years. We have conventions and new officials are elected. In my position, I negotiate the master contract for the West Coast. All the locals in the West Coast have one contract. This is to standardize conditions and eliminate competition between workers and between ports. There's approximately 3,500 people in the Canadian area of the Longshoremen's Union, which is an international union and affiliated to the Longshoremen's Union across the line in the western seaboard of the United States. We function only in the western seaboard, Alaska and Hawaii. On the east coast, the longshoremen are in another union that's called the International Longshoremen's Association, which stretches from Newfoundland right down to the Gulf of Mexico. We have fraternal ties with this organization, but we're a complete and separate entity. In Canada, we negotiate our own contracts, our own labor contracts, which is a master contract, as I've indicated, but it's decided, the program is decided by Canadian people in caucuses. A caucus is really a mini-convention where the policies and program that will make up a new collective agreement is implemented. It's not implemented, but decided. And then we go to the bargaining table to decide to attempt to obtain what the membership has asked for. This port has about 1,700 union people working on the dock. There's a workforce of about 400 casuals. These are 400 registered casuals who obtain benefits derived from the collective agreement. There's also another group of approximately 600 who come down and obtain casual work when the work opportunity is there for them. It's, I suppose, a little difficult to grasp. It's a different type scene than, a plant, where you go into a plant or every day and you go to the same job and your workforce is fixed. You know that you need so many men to operate that machine, so many men to handle the end product. But in shipping, it's a little bit different. The ships come in and the ships go, and you build up a workforce one day and tear it down the next. So your workforce is never always in a state of flux. It's difficult to determine the manning, and that's how come we arrive at a large number of casual people doing the work. You might get a ship in one day or ships in one day that don't need much labor. The next day you'll get one that's really labor intensive, and you'll have, for instance, if you're stowing flour in sacks, 100-pound sacks, you need a lot more people than if you're lifting off containers from a ship. So this has to be taken into account and has been taken into account by the various hiring practices that have existed or came into being since, well, approximately 1935. This union can't claim a long history of existence. This union was smashed in 1935, but has since then has rebuilt itself and formed the structure that exists today. The benefit we see in master contracts for the ports is one, it establishes portability of pensions throughout the various ports and portability of what's commonly called fringe benefits. That is life insurance, weekly indemnity, extended health coverage, and medical coverage generally. Long-term disability is a very important thing, which couldn't be done unless there was a central body coordinating the hours of work and obtaining the money for the benefits. This we achieved in 1963 when we used to bargain with employers on a separate basis. There was two sets of employers. One was the Shipping Federation of British Columbia, which represented the ship owners, the stevedoring class, and the agents. The other was the BC Wharf Operators Association, which represented the docks. They were separate entities, and we negotiated with them separately. But in 1963, they were put together, and a little bit further in 1966, so now they're one entity, and they're called the British Columbia Maritime Employers Association. They represent about 75 companies. Many of them, well, most of them, for the by and large, are international. Ships are international, so we had to build a structure that could cope on equal terms with the employer group we were negotiating with. The Shipping Federation of Canada, which was in existence in the East, represents all the ship owners and the people engaged in the maritime industries in Canada. Finally, we had the Shipping Federation of BC, which was part of that, and the overall governing factor is the Shipping Federation of the World. In the ILWU, we belong to the Canadian Labor Congress, and of course the BC Federation of Labor, the Canadian Labor Congress, and through the Canadian Labor Congress are affiliated to the AFL-CIO, which is the largest structure in the continental type setup that exists in labor unions. We also belong to the ILO and the ITF, which is the International Transport Federation, because we deal with these people, as I stated, on an international type approach to problems. We, of all the per capita collected, so much is set aside into a fund, and this fund is utilized to send labor delegates all over the world. We go to all the different countries and talk to the workers in those countries and have established good liaisons through the years with, I guess, about every country there is. I don't think we've ever had the opportunity of getting into China, but that's about the only other country. They're the only country we've never been in, but we're hopeful in the future that we will get there. To get one of these overseas trips, you can't just, you can't be an officer. You have to be a rank and filer, because there's political overtones, of course, if an officer was to go. I was working on the docks. My home port is Westminster. I was working on the docks there in 69, and I went to Czechoslovakia, which was a very interesting trip, as that was in 69. The big turmoil existed there in 68 when the Russians came sweeping in there, and we'd had a delegation there in 67, so we went over to talk to the people to see, you know, just what the true picture, if we could get a true assessment of the picture before and after type approach. Basically, we have attacked the problem of mechanization, which has affected all ports throughout the world in a rather different way than they did in the East Coast. We embraced the machine. We had the usual large gangs that existed on the West Coast at that particular time. We cut our manning back to fit the type, a new type of vessels that were being made. Consequently, this port has about the smallest gangs in the North American continent. Our rewards for this, you know, because these things are negotiable, was a certain sum of money when a person retired. If a person was a member of the workforce in 1962, August of 62, and works 25 years in the industry and is age 65, he gets the pension that we've negotiated, and a lump sum of $13,000 cash. This was to compensate for the reduction in manning and to reward the people who had been there previous to 62 when mechanization really came in, This is to reward them for their labors in the actual hand stowing of the cargo. With mechanization came the more sophisticated machines which exist in the docks today. There's the old days of having a strong back and a weak mind, they're pretty well gone, you know. I don't claim to have a weak back and a strong mind, but I worked down on that waterfront since 1946, so I've seen a lot of changes. A lot of changes in the hours of work and a lot of changes in conditions. But I think that's what's kept this port pretty well up where it is. It's the number one port in Canada. Part of that is geographic, and part of it, I like to believe, is through the productivity of the people who work in that port. Because our people are, by and large, skilled people now. If you've been down there, you've seen the large straddle carriers, the different types of equipment used to take the cargo off the ships. They're more sophisticated than they ever were, and consequently, the need was there for a training program, which we have up to a certain extent. We're not pleased with the training program. It could be better, but we're working towards that end. But this enables the cargo to move far faster and makes a more flexible type employee. One who can drive a lift truck one day and a straddle carrier the next and a winch the next. And in this port, with the large volume of bulk that goes through here, we have bulldozer operators, front end loaders, and also the setting up of the bulk terminals brought in unit trains, and which is a kind of an automated process for potash or coal. They're quite complicated things. When you start dumping these cars, they dump about one a minute. And, that's 100 tons. So you have to set the series up, and away she goes. From then on, she's pretty well automated. But people had to be trained to do that, and we've trained these people. And the productivity that we've engendered has led to a lot of business in this particular port. This is not a port that, say, for instance, Seattle is, which is pretty well oriented only to containers. We've watched the advent of containers on the West Coast. We've learned from the mistakes that the locals down south have made, the union down south has made. And, we didn't have to be brought dragging and kicking into the 20th century here. We don't regret the fact that the machine age has caught up to us, but we have certain strong ideas in regards to containers, and this has led to a lot of, I think, misunderstanding in the general public and certain frustrations amongst our employers. The container clause that exists within the collective agreement states various things and is rather difficult to read and a little more difficult to interpret. When we were in negotiations, we'd run into this problem, which is a complex one, and we're fighting with the language, attempting to get down on paper what our thoughts were. We were unable to do this from the union side with any degree of effectiveness, so we turned it over to the employers. They wrote the clause, and we agreed with the clause. And after we wrote it, lo and behold, they couldn't figure it out. You know, but that's the fortunes of war. But that's led to some of the general misunderstandings which I think exist today. As president of the union, I was appointed by the Liberals to sit on the Vancouver Port Authority, representing labor, and to make whatever contributions I could in that end. I have quite a knowledge of the harbor. You know, when a guy works there 25 years or so, he should know a little bit about it. But part of the problem that exists within the port was the lack of development. Docks hadn't been built for some 30, 40 years. The docks were old. The Centennial was the latest addition, and it had been made in the Centennial year. And with the new technology, even it lags far behind anything they've got down south. I don't know if you've gone into the details on the structuring of the National Harbor Board, but the National Harbor Board does control this port. Of all the ports in Canada, this is the only port that shows a profit. All the rest of them, I've forgotten how deep in the glue Montreal is. I think it's only 50 million or something like that. They're in the hole. But this port shows a profit of $1 million. And this has pretty well been consistent with its history. This port seems to survive in spite of itself. There's no new developments, but through the assistance of the Port Authority and the concerned business people on that authority, pressure was applied to Ottawa, and there's now two docks being developed, which will greatly enhance the capabilities and potential of this particular port. One of them is Lynn Term and one is Van Term. And on those two docks, there'll be a couple of container cranes, which should be adequate enough to handle the volume of traffic anticipated in the future. And these type cranes won't only be confined to that, the taking off of containers, but they've taken a different approach, I think, spurred by the activity on the Westminster waterfront, where the Westminster Harbor Commission has already, well, by the end of next month, I guess there'll be in operation two container cranes, which are probably the largest in the North American continent. But these cranes are geared not only to containers, but also to any other cargo that's around. They can pick up a load of steel, and we import much steel into this country, as you're probably aware. It's a national disgrace that we have to import steel when we export our iron and our coal to Japan to make the steel and bring it back. But nevertheless, that exists. So these cranes are capable of lifting up the tremendous volumes of steel that must come into this country if construction is going to go on. These are the same type of cranes that will be on Van Term on the south shore here and Lynn Term on the north shore. If it's ultimately determined by the engineers that those containers, those container type cranes are needed on the north shore. At present, it's slated to handle the pulp and paper from up the interior, of which the volume is ever increasing as they continue to develop pulp mills up there. Most of it will come down our railway, the DC railway, so it will sense, it's only common sense that it should go over those docks on the north shore because that's where the terminal is. There's tremendous problems in the port in regards to rail traffic. I guess you could write a thesis on that and never find an answer. They've had studies, many, many studies, and it's just that, unfortunately, on the geography is beautiful, but the ribbon development, the small little bit of flat land around the perimeter of the inner harbor, you know, negates any expansion of rail traffic in that area, and consequently causes a bottleneck, because the tremendous surge of wheat and other cars into the Port Mann and Port Coquitlam area, there's a tremendous number of cars in there. They have to be funneled through a small, very small, narrow neck to get into the harbor here, and consequently the turnaround is extremely slow. It's quicker to ship the wheat out from Saskatchewan or Manitoba than it is to get it from Port Mann to the elevators. Which should, you know, the elevators, they perhaps need a little looking into too, because they're, none of them are modern. Even the latest one they've built over at Neptune on the North Shore, you know, it leaves a lot to be desired. I sometimes wonder if there's not enough concentration in the engineering field. So we have to, I can't believe that Canadians are that thick-witted that they can't look after the country better than they do. But I also understand that emphasis is placed on certain things like forestry and mining, because that's what we're determined to do. Like I was saying to Mr. Francis, we seem to be determined to ship Canada out of here, you know, until there's nothing left in Canada but a hole in the ground. That's the way this country seems to be progressing. But it does create a certain volume of traffic through the port. As I stated, this is the number one port that is in Canada. I've been to most of the major ports, and we are unique in the fact that we exist in one province. Canada's western seaboard is located in one province and consequently governed by one set of laws. Well, I don't know how much more I can tell you. I will tell you this, I'm prepared to answer any questions you can ask, or I do my best.
Just a question of curiosity. You said that the labor, or that the union, has a quite different view of containerization than it seems to be publicly accepted or seems to be advertised. What is that view?
Well, the container clause says is that if a container was to come in with goods destined for the Vancouver area, it could go directly to a warehouse, providing the owner of the goods owned the warehouse, and be unloaded there by any labor that particular importer had, you know, and at any rate that he set amongst his employees. If the guys were getting $2 an hour, there's nothing the union could do about that, or would be concerned about doing about that, because that container is a free container. It's a store, what we call a store door container, and it could go there and be unloaded. Well, this doesn't seem to be generally accepted. That's one of the things. The other problem that exists in regards to containers is that if there's a container, say, for Woodward, and in that container are goods for the Vancouver area, but also goods for Campbell's. Well, we say that's a consolidated container, and that container will be unloaded on the docks. You see, what I perhaps should have explained is that when break bulk was coming in, which is what you call general cargo, the cargo now in containers, we done all that work. And when they bought in containers, we maintained that the container itself was no more than part of the ship. So we should do the work on that ship because our people had traditionally done it through the years and with the acceptance of the other unions in the area. And we wish to, you know, continue to do that work, because if you haven't got work, you know, you can have the best contract in the world. You can get $20 an hour, and that's a fine contract. But if you haven't got any work, work opportunity to earn $20, you got nothing. It's a problem, I think, that faces a lot of unions these days in the face of automation. It's job security, work for the people.
Well, can I just ask you, then, there's been a great deal of things in the paper lately over the past year or so about Seattle's container facilities being much, much better than Vancouver's, and that consequently a lot of cargo that is destined for the West Coast is going into Seattle for the simple reason that it's much cheaper for the companies to ship to there. Now, what if I don't understand, I mean, I think ultimately that if a union takes a view of trying to not necessarily block containerization but control it, then the port is ultimately just going to lose business, and then it will mean less work for less people.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes two to tango, and yeah. The container clause was, as I've explained, it wasn't just drawn up by the union. And there are certain fundamental reasons why the employers wanted the container clause to be the way it is. And one of it was to keep the work on the dock so they could make a buck. And, of course, in the spin-off, we'd make a dollar, too. But the situation in Seattle is a little more complex than that. The port of Seattle is owned by the city. They also own the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, SeaTac. They actually own and control that port. They have a mill rate of, I believe it's 3 mils, which generates approximately $6 million that they can pump into that port, and they have revenues from the ships that come in of another $6 million. So they have a cash flow of $12 million. They have a line of credit of $30 million. Whenever they want to build a dock, they merely build a dock. Here, to get any money out of the Treasury Board, you got to go down there with Peavey's and Prieto. And that's part of the problem. We're too far west. There's not enough attention paid to the development of the port. Seattle, the people down there in that particular port there, it's Local 19 of the ILWU, they were almost starving to death previous to the advent of containers. And when the containers come in, that local, which had a membership of about 1,800, now they haven't got work for 800, because the containers come in the dock and they're gone. A lot of them to Canada, that's true. But the interesting thing there is that shipping rates are set by shipping conferences. They set the rates. Canada has no merchant marine, no ships, consequently can't get in those conferences, so they set the rates. But the interesting thing is that a ship can come in there, discharge a box or a can or a container, put it on a truck and bring it up here, well, right up here to False Creek. For the same price, they can put it over the docks in Vancouver, because that's how the freight rates have been adjusted to accommodate such a thing. This happened in 1969. You see, there's a thing called the OCP, which is Overland Common Point, which was introduced into Canada to equalize or compete with cargo which left, say, Japan and came around through the canal up to the East Coast, and then was transshipped back to Vancouver. To fight that particular thing, the government seemed fit, and rightfully so, to put a special rate for cargo coming into Vancouver and going to the edge of Manitoba. A special preferential rate was established. They then took this rate and applied it to Burlington Northern, which runs down to Seattle. So it's just as cheap for them to come into the better facilities in Seattle. So perhaps better facilities will answer part of that problem. But it's absolutely amazing. We've discharged containers here destined for Seattle, put them back on the container ship, and the container ship's taken it to Seattle, and they've transshipped it back up here. Yeah, it's an amazing thing.
What is the difference in turnaround time for a ship coming into Vancouver and a ship coming into Seattle?
Well, it's quicker for them to come into Seattle. It's quicker because we have one poor, limping old container crane here, which will only discharge you know, a certain section, yeah, and then load a certain section. Down there they have two, sometimes three, so they can load and discharge at the same time. And that's the name of the game these days. Container ships is the turnaround time. But also Seattle will tailor-make things for a particular shipping line. They've tailor-made docks for Sealand, especially for Sealand, because Sealand rolls on wheels. They have wheels in their containers. And the average container, you can stack one on top of one another about four high, depending on the size of your straddle carriers or transporters. But Sealand has to spread theirs flat, so they need a broader area, a bigger dock space, bigger apron.
Would you recommend then that Vancouver Harbor be under the control of Vancouver City?
Well, I think some type of regional control should definitely be established, and that's the program that the Vancouver Port Authority is on. However, I think, you know, as responsible Canadians, that the port doesn't belong to Vancouver. It belongs to the prairie farmers, it belongs to the loggers up in the interior of BC, and to the mining maybe up around Hudson Hope, you know, and up in the Northwest Territories. So that type of approach, if taken, I think would prove far more effective than the antiquated one that exists today. The different types of structures, like the Fraser River Harbor Commission or the Nanaimo Harbor Commission, these commission-type ports seem to function better than this one here, which is, in my opinion, too bound up.